Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast. I'm Harry Evans, Director of Craft and Strategy at Cyence. And today, I have a special guest with us. It's a voice you may recognize because it's my co-host, the CMO of Cyence, Eric Quanstrom. Eric, great to have you with us.
Yeah, happy to be here, back here.
Here again. The other side of the table. So for those who don't know, because we try not to pitch ourselves on this podcast, Eric is, well, first of all, a colleague of mine who I very much enjoy working with, the CMO of Cyence, and he has a very interesting background. Eric, you started at News Corp, for those who don't know, that's Fox and companies like that. And then worked through, it looks like, five different CXO roles, usually CMO, companies like Logitech, most recently Kite Desk, where I actually worked with a lot of the people that were under you at Outreach. And then ultimately Cyence. That's a heck of a background.
Yeah, and time flies because I've actually been at Cyence now for almost half a decade. Enough gray hairs on my head and having done the CMO role many times over, it lends a very interesting perspective, especially to sales development, which is the meat of the topic we're going to jump into today.
Yeah, half a decade at our company is half a century in Cyence dog years. So that's a long time. Well, the topic today, there are a number of topics, but they're all related. Obviously, this is the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, and the topic today is really seeing that from your perspective. You've just had so much that you've gotten to see. You've gotten to see so many clients and so many iterations of Cyence along with these other companies. I mean, Kite Desk was ahead of their times as well, and in no large part or no small part due to you. So the topic today is really going to be getting your perspective on these things. And where I'd love to start is just hearing a little bit about Cyence in general, what Cyence is, not a full pitch or anything like that for those who might think we're turning this into that kind of an episode, not at all. But what is Cyence and what's unique about it?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that I would start just to join the answer from before, I've seen over 1,000 clients in my time here. And what we do is we help people with their top of the funnel. We help people start sales conversations. That's what Cyence is. So you may think of that as traditional outbound, where we're going direct response. We are using multi-channel strategies to start those sales conversations, usually with an appointment, a qualified appointment, that we then hand off to our clients. What's unique about it is the way that we do it. And a lot of the programmatic activities that we've designed, we're big believers in a number of what I would call macro trends that affect our business and affect the efficacy and efficiency of the motion of how we go to market on behalf of our clients. Let me give you trend number one. We're heavy believers in sales specialization. We believe that the sales department is actually one of the last departments to become specialized. And through specialization, you can unlock expertise, efficiency, and ultimately you can educate people, sorry, I alliterated there with some ease, on the benefits of letting closers close, letting account managers manage, letting prospectors prospect, and letting researchers research, so that ultimately you have kind of a value chain of human beings that best case scenario are all performing super specific roles to the best of their abilities with more outcomes on the line because of specialization.
I want to dig into that a little bit more before we get to some of the other points that you have in mind.
Sure.
What makes hyperspecialization worthwhile? Why has Cyence kind of redirected itself around that whole idea?
Well, one of the big reasons is this has been studied many times over by a behavioral psychologist, and there's a tremendous cognitive penalty to be paid from streams, which means that when people are doing one activity and then they shift to another, they lose a lot in the shift. In fact, that's usually where most time is lost in a knowledge worker's day. In fact, there's a great book, it's actually from over a decade ago, written by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and the book's called Flow. It was a New York Times bestseller, and it was a lot of the encapsulation of his body of research on exactly that. How does anyone get to the best performance of any given tasks or activity by doing just that. And the more limited or narrow range of tasks you can get to, the better off you are. And the more often you can reach what he termed or coined flow states, and the greater your chance of achieving expertise. Kind of similar to the concept of, you know, what Malcolm Gladwell popularized in his Outliers book, where if you have 10,000 hours doing anything, there's a really good chance that you can elevate into expert levels. As such, those fundamental tenets of specialization, 10,000 hours or not, you can still see huge benefits in doing any one activity over and over and over and over, largely because you can, first of all, hire into the expertise needed or the skill sets needed for that role. For instance, we talk a lot about SDRs and SDR craft here on this podcast. And one of the banes of most SDRs' existence is data and research and spending time doing it. And I would argue that most SDRs, they hate it for a very specific reason. They hate it because it runs counter to their entire personality type. So as a, for instance, at Science, one of the things that we do is we just don't have SDRs doing data and research. We have researchers doing that, where we can hire for skill sets like accuracy, detail orientation, organization, time management, where people that are very comfortable with essentially spreadsheets or cut and paste or analyzing information and then putting it, you know, very specifically, scrupulously into its necessary form factors can do that job wonderfully. And it's a win-win because those type of individuals will find kind of like their sweet spot or their flow at doing their tasks, building a lead list. And so we've separated out like that particular form and function into the people and the personalities and the skill sets and the motivation and the mindset to do all of that right.
So this flow book, by the way, has been recommended to me now by no less than 5 different C-suite executives from major organizations who I respect. So recommend to all of our listeners looking for your reading list, add flow to your reading list. That said, it's really interesting what you say about SDRs being bad at research. And in my experience, there've even been a few that I've encountered that have been great at it. And often their other skills suffer because of it. They have so much better data and research that they don't have to be as good on the phones or they don't have to craft as great emails. And so you're right. Rarely have I seen the SDR that can do all of it well at once. And you're finding where they're best, where they enter that flow state and just plugging them in and saying, doing that all day. It's basically the approach.
Yeah. And instead of fighting human nature and instead of fighting division of labor, like Adam Smith coined this very well hundreds of years ago when, you know, he talked about exactly this, these kinds of concepts. They survive for a very specific and good reason. And I think that the sales departments of a lot of Renaissance organizations are just the slowest to adopt these concepts going forward. We think that there's tremendous power to be unlocked from that adoption.
So that's interesting. You know, we talked about you get to see a lot of these different companies and we're taking this hyper-specialization perspective, also building scalability in it. The question I have is, what are you seeing as patterns across the industries? And in particular, where do you think things are going over the next 3 to 5 years? What's totally standard and everyone thinks of as will be there forever that just won't be here 3 to 5 years as a standard in our industry?
Oh, that's a really good question. One of the things that I would give you as a start to that answer, and then we'll kind of circle around, is two of the other big trends that I see in the industry that are affecting Science and that we've jumped aboard the wave of. The second big trend after specialization that we've seen is the growth of the SDR role in and of itself, the growth of outbound as a go-to-market channel being very viable, especially for the fastest growing companies in the world. And I'm mainly segmenting down to just B2B, just business-to-business companies. Oftentimes, these are the companies that have raised a lot of venture capital or have professional investment, private equity in them, who have figured out that the necessity or the spark plug to growth is taking the story to the streets, taking it to the customers that they want on their wall, going right after the logos that, you know, frankly, will be your next case study that will then help feed and, you know, extend further growth, right? Where outbound helps inbound along those lines. So that's trend number two. Trend number three that we've capitalized on is really an adherence to and a belief in multi-channel approach. What do we mean by that? We mean the ability for us to attack on not just one specific channel when running an outbound campaign. It means multi-layering sequences to targeted audiences, targeted prospects or contacts, one by one by one by one, with individuals or humans like communicating one by one on those channels, but combining them for greatest effect. So typically in a sequence that we will run here at Science, we're introducing first and foremost the ad channel. Then we're, you know, backing up with email channel, phone channel, web channel, and oftentimes social channels like LinkedIn, and combining those all for great effect. So if I extend that out and those three trend lines, all of which are up and to the right and growing and showing success, that's more of the same over the next 5 years. In fact, I think we get even more entropy, even more complexity, because that's the way of the world and how everything always grows. So that if I were to forecast out, you know, into say 2030, like there will be more intricate types of engagements, channel by channel, done by very specialized roles that will ultimately gain in importance as the success warrants. And so you're going to just see more and more and more and more of the same. In fact, I think you'll see a lot more turbocharging. You've already seen a huge wave of tech stack funding over the last decade plus. I've been part of that on the software side and now on kind of like the people and services side. And we also have our own software arm here at Science where we're building tech that enables all of this to happen. But you're going to see even more of that, and it'll be even more specific to the situation. The word that I would use is hyper-targeting or hyper-personalization into each scenario, each touch that we might orchestrate going forward. So if I think about the client that hires us in, you know, say 3 years time, I think we're probably going to be running even more intricate sequences to that outbound target with the goal of starting up a conversation that is relevant to them to enter into on behalf of the brands that we represent.
You know, you mentioned something, well, you mentioned a lot that got me thinking, but one in particular, you mentioned some of these other channels, and there are a lot of questions we get constantly. There are a lot of misconceptions out there. So when we think of the main two channels, I think most people would agree it's phone and it's email. Some people would say it's just phone or it's just email, but phone and email are the center of our industry. When we look at the other channels, let's say LinkedIn, for example, it's pretty central in our space now. Everybody knows about it at the very least, if not using it. When you add that to a campaign, do you find that a big percentage of the meetings that are set come from LinkedIn channels, or what is it bringing to the table when you add that?
Well, the first answer is no. LinkedIn, usually, unless it's an anomalous campaign, does not lead in total number of appointments set. That said, it is absolutely a worthwhile channel to pursue, even in lieu of results, because one of the things that is hard to trap and hard to attribute is the lift that is caused by awareness. Marketers actually understand this concept, I think, pretty well. Most marketers kind of grew up with the law of seven, where repeated exposure to a brand actually self-reinforces, because when you have brand familiarity, you have a lot. You know, there's a huge difference between and preference and reciprocality that come with familiarity. So if I really break down the essence of any outbound campaign, hey, you're still on the same ADA curve: awareness, interest, desire, action. If you ain't got awareness, you can't proceed to interest. So combining channels to raise awareness is still the number one kind of like technique to starting any conversation, right? Like, and then you have to move through the rest of that model. You have to move through, well, what is interesting to people? Well, most prospects are, what I would argue, and we teach and train this all day long at Science, they are self-interested above all else. And that's not a bad thing. It's not a pejorative concept. Self-interest is what drives most people's actions, right? And in a business context, that oftentimes means, how do I get more? How do I be more? How do I do more? Or how do I save? Or how do I advance? Ultimately, whatever that contextualization is, interest is connected to desire in the way that, like, if what somebody is coming in cold and asking me to do that just connected with me on LinkedIn, and so I'm aware of them, sounds reasonable and relevant to me, and it can further my own goals, you have engagement. You have that action, the final A in ADA, that most sales or vendors are always looking for, right? And it's actually a pretty neat little equation when you think about it. I like to think of science as being in the business of, we're not in a zero-sum game. For us to win, nobody has to lose. We're creating, in a sense, something from nothing. We're creating conversations where none existed before. And if we're doing it with value, especially for the clients that we represent, we're introducing new products, new services, new ways of doing things, better ways of doing things that can benefit each and every person that we're reaching out to. And so, you know, we have a rule at Science that we don't take clients who are, you know, proliferating in pornography or weapons or, you know, like any of the industries that would be harmful to a society. Instead, we have a lot of B2B clients that literally do just need new avenues to raise awareness, generate interest and desire, and ultimately get folks into their sales pipelines.
What's funny, I've heard you say in the past that sales development lives on the line between sales and marketing. And it sounds like what you're saying is essentially those other channels in a lot of ways are, it's almost like personalized marketing to your individual prospects, not so much to get a meeting, but it's a way to increase the chances of getting that meeting through the traditional channels later on down the road.
Yeah. And it what's kind of funny, and this is a heretical statement, but I think that even the term sales development is maybe a little bit of a misnomer. The reason is because at the top of the funnel, when you're just starting a conversation, you're actually really not selling. If anything, and again, this is something we teach and train at Science, what you're selling is a meeting. What you're selling is a journey. What you're selling is the opportunity to lean in and learn more about a product or a service, which I know it could be semantics and we could be just arguing about words, but that's marketing. And so, yes, it is little mini marketing engagements that make up most sales development. If you really break it down to its core, you know, there's the start point of segmentation. Which customers do we want to go after? You know, unsuccessful outbound campaigns are very broad. They're very unsophisticated. They're very undisciplined. It'd be like, you know, if I was just focusing on the calling campaign, grabbing a phone book, starting at A and ending at Z. Complete inefficiency, waste of time. Instead, outbound offers a bunch of things as a go-to-market channel that other go-to-market channels can't deliver on. Number one should always be this idea that I get to choose my shot. I get to pick the direction I want to go in. I don't ever need to support outreach to a person or a company that I wouldn't do business with. Outbound strips that out at the very outset, you know, and the lead list that we build for clients all day long, you know, they get to approve or deny and say, yep, this account makes the list. Nope, this account doesn't. And so we never have the problem of like, well, this meeting didn't work, because we strip it out at the very top, even before the outreach comes about. And that's not an unimportant point when thinking about how to do outbound and do outbound right, because you do want to segment. And that's a fundamental marketing principle that starts everything going down a path. What that also means is that we can get super specific and super segmented on, once we do decide who we should be reaching out to, we can start to personalize to their circumstance, to their industry, to their geography, to their role, to their persona, and ultimately reap the benefits of doing so and doing so correctly. By the way, the biggest benefit is relevancy. The more relevant you are, the more success you'll have in outbound, axiomatically true.
I mean, it sounds like you're essentially taking the farming approach of marketing, sticking with a marketing approach, but you're moving to hunting and yes, essentially doing hunting at scale.
Yeah. In fact, I think it was John Miller, one of the co-founders of Marketo, that coined kind of like the seeds, nets, and spears type of analogy when thinking about going to market. And outbound is truly spears. I mean, you are literally, you know, looking underwater in this case, or as the analogy goes, for where to throw the spear, where to fire the spear into the exact fish that you want to, you know, catch and eat that night.
to move us over a little bit, similar conversation, but being the enterprise sales development podcast in particular, you see a lot of enterprise engagements. And before we get into questions specifically about that, I'd love to define it a little bit more, because we were talking the other day about how there's really two types of enterprise engagement. There's, you know, the enterprise clients that we work with, the actual enterprise companies. How do I orchestrate my sales development group at that scale? And then there are the enterprise prospects that we go, that's a tongue twister right there, but the enterprise prospects that we go after for our clients. And the people who target those are very often startup companies, mid-sized companies, and everything along all across the gamut. So starting there, when you think enterprise sales development, what do you think of?
Yeah, I do think of enterprise two ways. And taking the second one first, it is the desire of a lot of businesses across the spectrum, especially in B2B, to go right up to the top of the mountain. You know, I want the Fortune 500 as the target that I seek for, you know, marquee value, credibility, you know, name brand. Let's be honest. That's why penetrating the enterprise matters. Usually also associates, and this is another hallmark of outbound, successful outbound too, you can oftentimes correlate it to ACV, right? So again, choosing your shot also can mean like, I want to sell to big companies. I want to sell to enterprises. I don't necessarily want to spend my time selling to really small startups. And that's just fine. You know, that's a choice that we can support. And so when we say enterprise sales development, that second half is one that is really important, and it evolves thinking. And then of course, on the first note, when you are an enterprise yourself, it's very rare, especially in the B2B space, that you don't have or wouldn't have a go-to-market motion that is supported by outbound. And so how to run those teams, how to scale those teams, how to train those teams, how to go to market are the topics and frankly, the thought leaders or subject matter experts that we have on the podcast on a regular basis, because we want to learn. We want the insights from them of what's working and what's not. What are you doing at your organization or organizations in the past from these enterprise sales development leaders where they can, and we've already seen a ton of this in doing the podcast already, their thinking has evolved. It is sophisticated. They've come up the curve, largely because you can't run an enterprise sales development team as if you were kind of a 101 or a new to the world, new to sales development type of approach. It just doesn't work.
That's really interesting, because you have these questions that I hear all the time that are essentially about scaling these teams. And a lot of people would like it to be just fixed. You double the amount of people you have on the SDR team, you double the results. And I think if anybody has seen it, you have with an organization that approaching almost 1,100 people now.
Yeah, over.
it's great. It's hard to keep track of. So you've seen real scale and you've seen what goes into that. What are the type of considerations that people don't think about that they'll have with 50 SDRs that they don't have with three?
the number one in the headline, and I'm breaking no new ground in saying this though, is people. People and their own proclivities, their own strengths and weaknesses, skill sets. Again, the ability to manage more and more people is its own art, is its own kind of like root essence of the word management. Therein lies the challenge. Therein lies the scale. Because if you break it down into all of its fundamental component parts, each one of them has significant challenges to it. Let me throw a few contextual harnesses on this thought. Start with hiring. The fact that you have to go out and, you know, literally no one ever hires one-to-one, right? Like you don't just find the perfect candidate with, you know, one job offer and call it a day. You know, you're basically sourcing, and recruiting stats may vary here, but in our industry, it's anywhere between 15 to like 50, frankly, to find one suitable, good candidate that ultimately makes it through the ranks into the organization. So your hiring motion is by definition tremendously inefficient, and we're fighting to make it more efficient every single day, but it's not an unimportant piece to frankly get right and build a staff, build, you know, the right people on the bus, as Jim Collins might have put it. From there, and oftentimes with sales development, even in our specialized roles, you're not talking about like late career professionals with 20 years of experience. You're talking about oftentimes early career experiences that translate well into the role that we put you in. But for that to work, you have to lean really heavily into training, leveling up, methodologies, concepts, understanding kind of like, hey, what business are we really in? And so when I just think about kind of like, and then the third piece that would be really interesting and in kind of like a funny way to say this, but a hire, train, and retain model is that retention piece. Because ultimately, once you've hired the right person that you think will be a fit, especially in an SDR role, and you've trained them up, there's usually some sort of shelf life that exists, largely because the SDR role, for better or worse, is not seen as an end-all be-all, I'm going to be here for the next 25 years till they give me the gold watch type of role. Never has been. I don't know if it ever will be, but it's kind of, it comes with the territory. As such, that retention piece and the number of productive months, notice I use the word months, not years, for SDRs that, again, you've invested in, you've hired, you've, you know, poured training into is super critical, right? Like people washing out like within 6 months is, there's literally no ROI associated with that. And everyone that's listening to this podcast that is doing it themselves and is thinking about, again, that challenge between three SDRs and 50 SDRs, that's it right there, multiplied out. And it's math on the hire, train, and retain piece just with that number of headaches. I mean, you're taking the number of headaches from the hundreds into the tens of thousands is really what you're doing.
Well, it's so interesting. You know, it's the classic SDR leader's dilemma, where it doesn't matter how great an SDR you hire, their immediate goal is to find their way out of being an SDR. You know, if you're a great SDR, your goal is a year from now, maybe 18 months, to do something else for the most part. So, you know, how have you set up science a little bit differently to be able to handle that constant turn? I mean, even in a good situation, constant turnover at that position.
This is one of the reasons why we're back to specialization. So again, if I'm an SDR generalist and I've got a lot of different, you know, again, stream switching, cognitive load that I'm processing, and I happen to be really good at a few things which will carry me through, I'm usually eyes on the prize to, again, that next role, usually an AE role or some sort of sales role beyond the SDR. In a specialized model, that may not necessarily be part of the equation, or it's not the same equation, is a better way of putting it. And so that's one of the reasons that we've also embraced the model that we have here at Science. We think that the numbers seem to bear this out too. We seem to have better retention rates than the industry as a whole when studied in cohorts. I would also say that, you know, we've worked our asses off to build a culture and a business that people want to be at. We've seen a number of awards recently too, mainly from companies like Glassdoor and Comparably, that have said, because our employees were surveyed and they said, hey, this is a great place to work. We really love being here doing this job. And so it's no small feat to create the environment with which people then say, you know what? I see myself not just on the kind of the passenger train looking for the next exit to get off, but saying I'm on the ride for a little bit longer. That could potentially also be a little bit of the science secret sauce as I hear myself kind of giving away some of our secrets.
Well, shameless plug / congratulations as well. I should have mentioned this when we first started. It looks like Science, I believe just today, was placed for the third time in a row on the Inc. 5000 fastest growing private companies list of 2021. So I wanted to congratulate you because you've obviously been very, very central in that. So well done again.
Right back at you.
Well, thank you.
A rare award, you know, like not every company can make the list, if you will. It's funny. We were doing a little bit of homework. Funny research, right? There's over 8 million businesses in the United States alone today. That's like, in some respects, hard to wrap one's head around. And like the Inc. 5000 award recognizes like the 0.00001% of those businesses that have, you know, grown at a rate within certain parameters. You got to be, you know, like over, I think, 2 million in revenue by the third year under studying. It's a 3-year growth period to even make the list. And then where you're slotted on the list is another kind of like pedigree thing. So I'm super proud that we made it for the third time. And we actually increased our rankings from the three-year period ending in 2020, challenging year for everyone, right? Like
some things happened
over the previous three-year period ending in 2019. So yeah, I mean, that is a little bit of tooting our own horn, but whatever, you know, like...
You know, I'm going to fast forward in my notes a little bit because I think it ties into what we're talking about right now. You know, one thing that has always stood out to about science ever since I stumbled upon the group, you have done a heck of a job in not only branding science, but in establishing its web presence. If you look for a number of things related to our space and you look for science, I hope I'm not spilling the bean to competitors here, but science comes up and it comes up fast. That couldn't have been by accident. What have you done over the last few years to get science to a point like that?
I took an outbound approach to inbound marketing.
Interesting. What does that mean?
It means that if you map your buyer's journey and you really think deeply about the kind of person, the kind of people that would be buying your product, you go through kind of like creating a playbook for understanding how somebody gets through and ultimately gets to the place of being a hand raiser, being an inbound lead, if you will. The other thing I'll say about science that I would be remiss if I didn't include this is we drink our own champagne on the inbound side, on the outbound side. Every interaction that we have with our organization is first fronted by an SDR. Period, full stop, end of story. It's part of what we do and how we see the world. In fact, we define our key KPIs, key performance indicators, as appointments. Right? Like that's the one that we want to, our management team wants to see and report on and dashboard and look at all day long and understand like, hey, how many appointments, which are the demarcation, if you will, of solidified interest in our products and services that then our sales team can take forward on a buyer's journey towards some sort of outcome, like a closed one deal.
I can definitely attest to the fact that this is a number that's near and dear to the hearts of our leadership team. It comes up every now and then. And one other question about science, I don't want to make this entirely focused on the organization, but the science name, we get a lot of questions about that as well. Starting with how do you pronounce it? We get all sorts of creative ideas, science and science. I've heard some crazy ones, but can you tell us a little bit about how you came to science and how it's branded to the industry?
The beauty of our name is that you'll only get it wrong once. And you'll only need it corrected once because it's an intentional misspelling. It's six characters. Truth be told, we actually began life as a company known as Leadware. And the founder, who's now the executive chairman of science, Thomas Cornelius, you know, we were at a place in 2019 where we had an entire, or sorry, 2017, where we had an entirely new management team coming in. And technically what happened was science acquired Leadware. The branding and the associations and the positive nature of all things to do with science, like our little mascot, if you see the little rocket, we call him Liftoff. We love using like sciencey language, like hypothesis.
It's on your chest, by the way.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Liftoff's right there. But we love using kind of like sciencey language around finding formulas and testing hypotheses and running experiments. And, you know, a lot of the positive associations with achieving liftoff and scale and orbit and blasting off and launching, you know, like all of those things work really well with outbound. So it's kind of a natural match. And one of the reasons why we were kind of all in on, hey, you know what, this would be a great way to move the company forward from a brand perspective. It's very congruent with, we like to be cutting edge. We like to experiment. We like to push the envelope. And, you know, this brand kind of fit us, if you will. And I'd love to believe that I'm never going to be the arbiter of this or the decider, but I'd love to believe that our clients and the people that have found success with our company would agree that the brand is part of that journey or part of that equation going forward.
Well, I'm biased, but I'd like to believe the same thing as well. We try. Now, moving back to some of the enterprise concerns, we talked a little bit about so many companies out there are not enterprises themselves. A lot of them would like to be someday, but target into enterprises. And setting meetings with an enterprise that are worth anything is very difficult. Well, setting any meetings with them is very difficult, and then getting the right ones, it's a whole different ball game. It's kind of like seeing the world in black and white, and then all of a sudden somebody turns on color. So yeah, that's what it feels like sometimes. Yeah, exactly. So what are the things that are different? You know, we had a conversation earlier. I don't know if we had it as part of the recording, but you talked about how many companies want to penetrate enterprises. And I said, well, how do you do that? You said, well, you think like one. So what does that mean?
Well, I think that it means that you have to think about what is an enterprise at its root. It is an organization that has grown to the point of, A, not necessarily worrying about where their next dollar is coming from. Not necessarily like, are the lights going to stay on tonight? It's not the death of entrepreneurship, because a lot of enterprises struggle with innovation and, you know, like entrepreneurs within the organization, but it's achieving success in various fields and being able to continue to grow beyond there, right? Because here's the fun fact about all enterprises, especially publicly traded ones. They're always worrying about the next number, the next quarter, the next, you know, like forecast, the next what I tell the street, the next earnings per share. As such, enterprises have to be very good planners. They have to be very, not necessarily here and now, but here and now and into the near and medium future. And so if I take those concepts back to planning to penetrate an enterprise or think like enterprises think, that actually causes a huge mind shift for how I want to organize any activity, right? Like in an enterprise, there is no mandate to do anything yesterday, like almost ever. Now, are there needs? Are there fires? Are there burning desires to do certain projects? Of course. And so those two realities kind of like intermixed together are often like a yin and yang pull. And it's really interesting to design kind of like campaigns and strategies to penetrate people's thinking when those are the rules.
So would you say it becomes more, you know, you talked about funding and not waiting for the next paycheck. So does it become more about value than about cash flow when you get to that level? Is that one of the major differences?
Well, yeah, yes, to a certain extent. You know, cash is king, even in the largest businesses in the world. Like anyone that's ever read a most recent Q2 report of Apple, actually, and this still blows my mind, right? Like coming in at almost $40 billion just for iPhone sales and going 50% year over year is, it defies gravity to me. And their cash hoard is unbelievable. But, you know, taking it forward back to Outbound, here's what's interesting about some of the thinking that a lot of our clients come to us with big dreams, big ambitions, and oftentimes it's same title. So let's say that we have a mid-market or a startup company with the CEO who's hired Science and all of a sudden, you know, has this idea, oh, I really know CEOs, and may even design an ICP that says something like, hey, I want to penetrate companies of 1,000 employees or more in this specific industry or geo or what have you. And to reinvoke our Apple example, well, the CEO of Apple would be this guy named Tim Cook. However, the probability of getting Tim Cook into an appointment is, I don't know how many zeros you have to throw behind the decimal point, but it's a lot. Not saying it's impossible, but probable, not so much. And so what's interesting there is thinking or tuning one's thinking around, would Tim Cook even be the buyer of your product or service? You know, hey, you are at your company, like the check signer, the CEO, but at an enterprise of, you know, 150,000 employees and, you know, multi-trillion dollar market cap, maybe not. And therefore, that thinking, that deep, rigorous, planned thinking on who the buying group might be at a company like Apple deserves its own best thought, deserves its own, again, rigorous is the best word I like to use here, and maybe even overuse, approach.
You know, you're making my job easy here, because the next note I had to ask you about was buying groups. It's funny that you mentioned that, but it's a big topic that we see come up a lot. You mentioned if it's not Tim Cook, that we should look for the buying group. You didn't say the person. So can you talk about that a little bit more? What is a buying group, and how has it become even more relevant these days?
This is actually another super interesting area for me, trendline watching. Because what I've observed, and every analyst firm known to man studies this as well. So whether you're a Forrester guy or a Gartner guy or in any of the firms that they've acquired that used to study this obsessively, like Serious Decisions or Corporate Executive Board, CEB, all of them say the exact same thing, which is buyers nowadays, there's more of them and there's more of them in the room deciding. And what the word that pops out to label this is the consensus sale or the consensus purchase. So what we've watched with these analyst firms is the buying groups for any product or service have gone radically up. And I don't know where the stopping point is. It's already in the double digits, especially when you're talking about like enterprise purchasing. You know, I think Gartner put it at 10.2 folks in the buying group. But this goes back to that rigor. And so the ability for me to understand, all right, who is that 10.2? It's not an anonymous, faceless number. It's 10 individuals with 10 different titles, potentially different departments, that would consist of these seats at the table, all influencing whether or not to decide to do business with you. And since what we're after in an outbound scenario is starting sales conversations, we have to figure out, who should those conversations be started with? If we make the mistake of only assuming that the end user or the end buyer is what we would traditionally call a decision maker, I take that to mean the dictionary definition of decision maker, which would be the autocratic, on an island, no other input, I'm making the decision all by myself. That's a unicorn. That person doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. You know, we heard somebody say, maybe in another episode we recorded, so I don't want to spoil all the goodies, but we heard somebody at one point talk about how there's almost never someone who can just say yes themselves, or at least who will, but they can all say no. That's the problem with that group.
Yeah. And so I like to think about buying groups as what is the role or what is the, and I'm going to invoke another kind of methodology because I think it's really instructive. Anyone that follows Jobs to be Done, it was actually originally created by Clayton Christensen and Bob Moesta, if I'm not mistaken. So you can look at the hashtag JTBD, or you can read any of the books around Innovator's Dilemma, I think talked a little bit about this. The jobs to be done when it's on a buying team, oftentimes people will assume roles that are not even part of their title. Some of the common ones include user of a product or service. Other common roles include integrator of a product or service. Other common roles include consumer of a product or service. And this is most often seen with like an analytics dashboard or some sort of, you know, view into what the product or service is doing for an organization. But just those three alone are huge, kind of like not necessarily always on the map for who we should penetrate with outbound campaigns. And I think that's a mistake. I really do. Because oftentimes what you're ignoring is those that are more probabilistic and relevant. Because let's be honest, right? Like if your job is affected by a piece of software that you use, of course you're going to have input. Of course you're going to have an opinion. Of course, like depending on the organization and its hierarchical structure, that opinion might carry a lot more weight than a theoretical or mythical C-level title who doesn't really understand the problem, deal with it, or have the implications to really have desire towards an action of a meeting. So really what you're talking about is, who are the right people to be bringing our story to start a sales conversation? Is it kind of like an assumptive exercise to where I just assume that the bigger the title, the better, because that's just the way that I've always thought? Or is it, again, more rigorous around who's actually bought my products or services in the past, who's used them, who's implemented them, who's gotten benefit from them, and what roles did they play in getting to the starting line, in getting that product sold?
You know, when you mention getting to the right person, that can be a trap term for a lot of people, a lot of our clients, a lot of our listeners. So I want to start with something, because at first I think, okay, that's persona. And then something else you were thinking, you said, I thought, ooh, that's ICP. So let's start simple. Can you define what those are and what the difference is?
Sure. So ICP is an ideal customer profile. What that is an idealized state of, if I could have any customers in the world using my product, who would they be? And you would actually have an ICP starting at the account level, because you'd want a logo over and above like an individual. to put on your own website, to put on your own collateral, to show off in your, you know, overview deck that, you know, I've got, I don't know, 5 of the Fortune 10 using my product. So that's kind of like an ICP, and it has many more dimensions, but that's the headline. A persona, on the other hand, is really around its person plus A. It's a contact level view into what is the role? What's the job? What do they worry about? What do they have to get done? And so you're going to see a lot of personas on an ICP, but they're not the account, right? Like persona deals in contact level data or contact level thinking. What do CMOs worry about, you know, these types of companies when they go to bed at night, right? Like that's a persona conversation. Putting them onto a key ICP lead list as a desirable customer, completely different. So both are work hand in glove with one another.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So they are interlocking pieces. You have to find the right company, you have to find the right person within the company. And based on what you said about buying groups, that makes a lot more sense. You're finding the different personas that build up that group that you can sell to get your ideal customers.
It's like the human essence of, you know, if I know what somebody is worried about, is concerned with, what their goals are, what they want to achieve, what bugs them, what their discomforts are, like that's all persona level data that I can use to further my engagement cause with that individual. And the more I know about a given role, the more these patterns will hold. You know, like it's not uncommon to find, especially at similar sized companies, controllers or CFOs or directors of IT or, you know, marketing managers, all performing relatively similar functions and therefore having relatively similar kind of like concerns, being relatively similar personas. And so doing that homework, doing that kind of like work to understand the persona is, I think, really important and goes a long way towards campaign success.
You know, one last question along these lines. When you are teaching our team how to craft messaging, when you're teaching how to craft a value proposition, for example, do you think it's more important to have that speak to the value as seen by the company, like the ICP, or by the persona, the person we're targeting?
It depends on how we want to, like, the way I say that is actually a little bit of a blend of both. Ideal state for outbound is to wrap any of the messaging that you are bringing forward in the lens of the person receiving it. Why? Because of everything that we explained at the earlier part of this podcast, which is we're all human beings. We all like have developed evolutionary traits, not the least of which is self-preservation first. I'm more important to me than anyone else in my circle and sphere of influence. Therefore, when I lead with a message that is, if I'm a vendor, all about the vendor, I'm actually decreasing my odds for receptivity tremendously. Now, if I understand that persona and I can wrap all of my messaging in the lens of here's why you should care or why you could care or why you might care, and I can bring in ICP information of we've worked with a lot of, you know, companies just like yours, right? Like a lookalike story, if you will, where I could have pure FOMO or I could really see a message as being like, oh, well, other CMOs of lead generation firms are doing what? And all of a sudden the message becomes very interesting to me, both from a persona level and an ICP level, because it's wrapped first and foremost in, forgive my vulgarity, but should I care about?
You know, I'd be remiss in doing this interview if I didn't bring this up. There's something that you like to teach anybody doing sales development, and I'm guessing it applies to marketing as well. You teach that there's 3 questions you like to ask, and I think I've heard you ask our team maybe coming up on a million times now. So what are the most important questions when you're crafting a value prop or a pitch to get someone's attention?
Yeah, and this is what I like to say about these 3 questions. This is the subliminal tape that plays in a prospect's head when they are reading, hearing, or otherwise accessing new messaging, new stimuli. And those questions are, why me, why now, why care? And I know that this is kind of like old hat in the outbound space. Like, they're not my questions. These have been asked and answered and, you know, talked about from a methodology perspective from time immemorial. But the reason why those three are the ones to focus on is, again, back to the ADA model, which by itself is over 100 years old. It was created by a funny named dude named E. St. Elmo Lewis, who was one of the original kind of like marketers that had a ton of success for a company back then known as National Cash Register. If you've ever heard the phrase ringing up sales, it was because they, you know, whenever they opened a cash register back in the day, in the early 20th century, it rang. Like, you literally hear a bell. And like, E. St. Elmo Lewis was their functional CMO. They didn't call him them that then. But at any rate, he created this ADA model. And so, you know, I like to think that is the brain map. Literally, that's the decision path that people go through. So if you think about why me, you know, why now, why care, they all fit very neatly into awareness, interest, desire, and action. And so if those elements are congruent and part of your campaign, you're already like, you're well on your way to creating success.
So I've got one last set of questions that I wanted to ask you. And at first I was going to break them into pieces. I'm thinking that this is essentially one topic. So I'm going to rapid fire two or three questions at you and just let you go. I've noticed, and I've said to others who will listen to me, that you're a unique CMO. You seem to understand sales and sales development a bit better than most. And I've worked with some great CMOs over the years, but you live in that space. We've done sales coaching together, and I actually welcome it, which isn't always the case between, you know, sales craft, sales development craft, and marketing leaders. But I'm curious about what you do differently and how you ended up having such a strong understanding from the different perspectives. I'm curious for if you have examples of what bad CMO thinking looks like without calling anybody out who we might love and appreciate. And just in general, why does that get that gap of understanding between sales, sales development, and marketing exist in the first place so widely?
Well, a few answers there. By the way, thanks for the compliment. I appreciate it. You know, I did have head of sales roles in my past career. So I've worn both coats, so to speak. When I think about bad CMO thinking, I actually think of, and I'm talking about my peeps, my brethren, my birds of my feather. So the word bad actually even hurts to use. But what I think promulgates some suboptimal thinking is, what got you here won't get you there. And what do I mean by that? I mean, a lot of marketers grow up, come up through the ranks at getting really good at talking about features, talking about benefits, viewing the world from a very like pointed perspective of describing their, again, product or service really, really well. And I think in the marketing space, especially, you know, in website design or talking about a web, you know, a product's features and building out like a, you know, piece of collateral or something along those lines, excelling at that particular skill is completely different than running outbound campaigns. Like, it couldn't be more different. Where the mistake happens is in applying thinking that says, oh, this scenario is just like that. Oh, this is where I just need to throw features at the people I'm talking at and expecting the same exact thing that happens on, say, ad channels. In fact, that's probably the best example because, you know, coming up through the ranks or, you know, like my own career, I used to work for News Corporation, better known to the world as Fox. And I got to admit that this was less than savory, but you'd walk the halls of Fox and people would talk about not customers, they'd talk about eyeballs. And the reason why is our true customers there were advertisers, right? Like, I actually witnessed an entire room of people get fired in one fell swoop because they had 30 seconds of black on a Major League Baseball playoff game where an ad didn't run. And it cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so, like, you know, in a sense, like the way that things are done, if you're a marketer and you're living in, like, say, Advil, is you're thinking about aggregating audiences. You're thinking about talking to thousands of people all with one message. Like, this is traditional advertising laid bare. This is TV advertising. You know, you're not narrowcasting. It's not one-to-one. It's Budweiser putting out the same ad for millions of people at a Super Bowl, you know, like, and aggregating around like funny stories or, you know, brand impressions, getting brand recall. That's marketing for a lot of folks who come up through the ranks. Outbound, on the other hand, again, very narrow, very one-to-one, very human. And the second that you start talking at people is the second that they turn off, shut down, and go away, usually silently. And so it's death in our industry to adopt the same techniques and patterns that kind of work for broadcasting or, you know, like talking to big audiences about, again, your product or service.
And I've heard you say, looking at outbound copy, that's marketing speak. Can't use that.
Yep. Yeah. And it, again, it's a dangerous trap. You use it because you want an economy of words. But what is lost in that equation is the consumer or the prospect that will consume that message. And when we lose them, like they vote with their attention and they go away, right? Like some are fond of saying we live in an attention economy. I don't disagree. And I think it's only becoming more so. So all of our trend lines, especially with hyper-personalization, mean that we're forever trying to grab more of that attention. How do you get that attention? Well, you've got to be relevant. That's the first bar to cross. If you don't cross that, you don't even get to second base, to mix metaphors.
All right. So this is the last question. I don't want to keep you too long today, Eric. What is your next pet project or fun thing on the horizon coming up?
Well, the next pet project, we just did a second pass of, this is such a sciencey take, but we looked at the industry that we're in and we did a cut across. The first cut was like the top 100 competitors in our space. And we ran all of them through this kind of like matrix that we developed where we had 82 different buying criteria that we felt like were leverageable for your average person to make a decision with an outbound lead generation company. Well, we've since expanded that to like 250 firms because we're in that broad of and complex and busy and noisy of a space such that we have the ability to put all that together. And it's on a site called the Lead Gen Mega. So if you go to leadgen.science.com, you're going to see the second pass of our analysis and treatment of our space. It's kind of like, you know, if someone ever said, hey, how do you solve this homework equation? The science take would be, let's think deeply about this. Let's go analyze. Let's be data-driven in our decision-making and our analysis. And then what we did was we put all the results together for everyone to go and explore. So, fun project.
So to stick with the math equation, you're going to show your work as well.
We showed our work. And what's different in version two is even more of kind of like the text-based approach where we describe and summarize and interpret some of the results that we've got.
That's awesome. Well, excited to see what's on the horizon. Want to let you go. Eric, this has been a really fun interview. And I want to give you a couple minutes if you want to just, we've kind of explained what science is, but if you want to give kind of a 2 or 3 minute pitch for those who are interested in learning more, please do.
Yeah, I mean, it's really simple. We help companies of all different sizes. At last count, we're over 200 industries that we've served in our short 6-year history. We come in and we're like a guide. We're a guide towards outbound growth. You know, ultimately, you're the hero. Our clients are the hero in the story. Why? Because all of the output, all of the outcomes, all the results that we generate are appointments that lead to your funnel, that lead to your pipeline, that theoretically should result in close one business. And so front-ending all of that and having the ability to grow and scale on demand and, you know, bring our science process to work with your organization is what we aspire to do.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Eric. It's been a pleasure. And I'll see you at work tomorrow.
Love it. Thanks, Eric.